The Supreme Court has been busy. By the end of June, that is to say, June 2024, the court had issued a welter of decisions ranging from presidential immunity to guns to federal agency regulatory power. It's a lot. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Outlook, where we try to offer an independent take on the issues of the day. Today, a group of our experts will give you the scoop and a quick assessment of the most pivotal recent Supreme Court cases. As always, I am joined by my colleague, Philip Magnus, holder of the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Welcome, Phil.
Happy to be here.
And I'm also joined by my perennial conversation partner, William St. Evers, Director of our Center on Educational Excellence. Great to have you, Bill.
Great to be here, Graham.
And today we're joined by three more experts. First, William Watkins, research fellow here at Independent and author of Crossroads for Liberty, who is a careful constitutional commentator. Hi, Bill.
Good to see you, man.
Also, Stephen Holbrook, senior fellow at Independent and author of many books on the legal history of gun freedom in America. Welcome, Steve.
Good to see you, Graham, and everyone else.
And finally, Christopher Calton, research fellow at Independent and a careful analyst of legal issues surrounding homelessness. Greetings, Chris.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start with the hottest and latest, which is to say Trump versus U.S., the presidential immunity case. I'm going to turn my question initially to Bill Watkins. I'm finding this case to be fairly straightforward, but its implications seem a little ambiguous. It seems to me, if I've got this right, Bill Watkins, it seems that the court has laid out a tripartite analysis, three kinds of situations. When a president is exercising his core constitutional functions, he has absolute immunity. When he's carrying out other official functions, but not his core ones, he has presumptive immunity. And when he's doing non-official stuff, he has no immunity. Have I got that right, Bill Watkins? And what do you think about this case?
No, that's absolutely right. That's the essence of the court's ruling. But of course, the real work in this case is going to come at the district court level, because the district judge is going to have to sift through in hearings, take evidence, and sort through what act was done, say, in an unofficial capacity or as candidate Trump, what act would be done in his core constitutional powers where there's presumptive immunity or total immunity, really. And then the presumption can be rebutted if, for example, say the president shares certain powers with Congress in a case, then it would be up. There would have to be a showing that to not grant him immunity would be a tremendous interference with the duties of the executive branch, essentially. So all that is going to have to be sorted through at the district court level, and that's going to be a lot of work, a lot of argument.
So that means that the district court has to go through all the charges against Trump and figure out which of them is core constitutional, which of them is non-core but presumptively immune, and which of them is non-official, and categorize them all before any prosecutions could proceed. Is that right, Bill Watkins?
No, that's absolutely right. We're going to have to go through the indictment, which is a speaking indictment, meaning rather than just bare bones citing the statute, as most federal indictments are, there are very specific allegations about what he's done, and we're going to have to go through each and every one of them to properly categorize them. Now, some the court did give a preview, such as, for example, conferring with his attorney general or officials at the Department of Justice is a core presidential duty. So we've got some idea there on a few of these things. But for many others, especially when there's a presumption, meaning that it can be rebutted, there's work to be done there. And also there's some evidentiary rulings that a lot of commentators have taken a look at, that, for example, even if the president has, if he has immunity, the court has indicated, well, that evidence really can't come in to paint a picture of what's going on, even if it's not an allegation that the jury has to determine. And it will be interesting to see how that will affect the trial or preparation, because even if something is not, say, key to finding him guilty, I mean, typically lawyers, prosecutors would argue you know, judge, this is a relevant piece of the puzzle that the jury is entitled to hear so they can have full context to understand the allegations we've made. The majority has ruled some of this out of bounds already. So that's an interesting evidentiary hurdle that Smith is going to have to overcome.
A quick question as a factual matter. So when President Trump was talking to his vice president before January 6th and telling him, you got to, you know, not count these electoral votes, was that his core constitutional official duties where he has absolute immunity or not?
Something we know? Be arguing about. As the court pointed out in the opinion, you could argue, well, Pence is simply serving as the president of the Senate and is exercising legislative branch duties there rather than executive branch duties. However, the court also pointed out that in the modern American government, the vice president is something almost of, and the at least even though his role in the Senate is ceremonial, you could argue sort of the floor leader in the Senate for the administration's policies. So does that put it more into the executive realm and entitle a presumption of immunity there? This is going to have to be worked out. There's a lot of arguments that can be made.
Bill Evers, you had a comment you wanted to make.
Yes, I actually had two comments. The first is a lot of the commentary and a lot of the complaints from progressive legal scholars have pretended, in my opinion, pretended, that this just came from completely out of the blue. How could anybody have imagined that this would be the ruling? And yet, we had the Nixon versus Ernest Fitzgerald case that had to do with civil cases. And why would legal scholars be surprised at a case that tried to extend those principles into the criminal law and maybe be a little more specific and careful about it, but still follow on the same track? It seems to me very odd. And then when you're done with that, I'd like to discuss how foreign policy and war powers and commander-in-chief fits into this.
Steve Halbrook, do you have a comment?
Just a clarification, the core constitutional duties of the president, the reason that he's got these exclusive powers, examples of it be commander-in-chief, and he has to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. He's the only branch of government who has those powers. And that's why I think it was a no-brainer to say that he would have absolute immunity in exercise of those powers. We can all think of horror stories like the dissents did, but I think this was the only conclusion that the court could reach. And I thought that the ultimate decision was very reasonable and very simple for that reason.
Yeah, so Justice Sotomayor, I think she's the one who said, well, he's the commander-in-chief, so he dispatches the military to kill one of his political opponents. So he has absolute immunity because he's the commander-in-chief. Is she right to pose that hypothetical? Phil Magnus?
Well, there's an interesting thing because she's posing that hypothetical, and the left has really seized upon it as like this decision is a carte blanche to do anything that Trump wants. These are the same people that were defending Obama ordering drone strikes on U.S. citizens abroad less than a decade ago.
Yeah.
So
Al-Awlaki, I think,
right,
was the name of the guy.
The son of a suspected terrorist that was in Yemen, and it was one of like three or four cases. There were even these ridiculous contortions of letters that Eric Holder issued as attorney general, basically saying, yes, we have the right to do this, and Congress, you cannot question us. And the left, the Democratic Party, was like, okay, well, we accept that.
Yeah.
And here we are.
So the question to my mind, though, is there any remedy when a president says, I'm commander-in-chief, even though this is undeclared war, I'm the commander-in-chief, and the person I'm attacking is not somebody with an imminent attack on the United States. I'm getting back to some debates in the Philadelphia Convention and comments by Madison and so forth.
There should be a remedy.
Well, I'm wondering if the Supreme Court has precluded a remedy.
No, there is.
Well, there's always impeachment and removal, right?
Right, right.
And there's impeachment, and then there's another election is always on the horizon. You can get rid of the guy. I mean, I don't like the idea of what Obama did to that American citizen in Yemen, and I don't like the hypotheticals that Justice Sotomayor has posed. But at the same time, I'm thinking ahead, well, so what if Donald Trump is elected again? And what if he makes good on some of his offhand comments about prosecuting, persecuting, putting Joe Biden in jail? Don't you think that if and when that happens, Joe Biden's attorneys are going to say, in Trump versus U.S., the president had
official
immunity.
Yeah.
And so, and that will preclude us from having an endless, cycle of, the next president prosecutes and jails his former opponents. And the president after that prosecutes and jails his former opponents. And an endless cycle of ridiculous.
Things like we're seeing in Brazil right now.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
So the immunity things.
I wonder if in another interesting flip of things, the arguments that the critics are making of the Supreme Court aren't really the arguments that a certain kind of individualist anarchist might make. In other words,
true.
The president is just another person. He can't do whatever he wants. He's just another person. He doesn't have any special prerogatives, right? Isn't that kind of a Lysander Spooner type argument? I mean,
Chris Carlson.
And so it's interesting that the progressives who are making this argument don't realize the logical implications of what they're saying.
Right, right.
Chris Carlton has something on that point.
Yes, that would be my argument. And I always think of Lysander Spooner here because I do have a little bit of the position, if the Constitution is wrong, I don't want to support it, like he had with so many issues. But immunity for anything, if you're in office, it's the same thing with qualified immunity for police officers. If we're going to have equality under a law, the law is supposed to not be arbitrary and it's supposed to apply to everybody equally, then I don't think there's any justification for any form of immunity for any office.
Even for like the dog catcher, he'd get immunity, right?
That's exactly it.
No, he gets a bite.
Especially, right.
He gets a bite.
Yeah, well, so to protect individual liberty, Chris Carlton is saying, we may need to run the risk of the chaos I was talking about, because otherwise liberty will be jeopardized with no recourse. Am I got your argument?
I also think there's a personal experience aspect to this. Many of the Supreme Court majority served in positions in the executive branch where they had to have the slings and arrows of lawsuits and similar things going after the president that they were serving under. And they observed that it was disruptive and it, distracted them from their purposes and so forth. And, a critic of a certain sort might say, so what? If you do the wrong thing, you should have these things happening to you. But I think their own personal experience about presidential flexibility, agility, capacity, purpose, whatever, affected them having heightened sensitivity about this.
Right. So we have a little bit of disagreement here, but I think what we're going to see is that the lower courts will then start sifting through all the charges against Trump and see which one fits in which category. It's not going to be an easy task, I fear.
Personally,
which brings me to the question of Fisher. Bill Watkins, yes.
No, I just wanted to say personally, while the majority opinion was well-reasoned, if I had my druthers, I think Amy Coney Barrett's concurrence to have essentially an as-applied challenge to each federal statute, say, that might be applied against a president rather than necessarily frame it as immunity, as the majority did, allow and recognize that the president can challenge the application of certain federal statutes, not that they're facially unconstitutional, but as applied in light of his executive office. Because after all, you know, the whole basis of whether it's immunity or an as-applied challenge, it essentially comes down to a separation of powers argument. That's the basis of this decision, is separation of powers, that the executive has to have this, whether it be the shield of immunity or challenging a statute as applied to him, that we cannot so inhibit the office of the president where he cannot perform needed constitutional functions there. So, I think well done for Justice Barrett and her concurrence, though the majority, the full majority, makes a good case for extending the Nixon precedent that Bill Evers talked about there. And it's unfortunate we've even come to a point in our country where we have to deal with something like this, that our current leaders don't leave it up to the political process. If Trump is such a terrible guy, and I'm not a fan in many ways, but let the voters can cast a judgment this November about what they think of him. But it's all an effort to try to take it out of the people's hands. So unfortunately, it's the left that has pushed us into this decision.
Well, off here.
That's a very interesting point,
Bill Watkins. As a footnote, I would mention that Ernest Fitzgerald was a libertarian or classical liberal, the one who was in the lawsuit against President Richard Nixon.
Before I turn the page, Steve Holbrook, do you want to comment further on this case, or let me continue?
Well, this is the day after July the 4th, and we know that the remedies of the next election or impeachment are always there. And the founders had another solution because things went so extreme. And it's I'm not advocating anything. I'm just saying.
Right.
I'm just saying that that's the ultimate solution to problems if they get that bad. And I heard Bill Evers' comment about Brazil. That's exactly what's going on right now. Bolsonaro has been indicted. Luna, the guy who's there now, he got out of prison, and I think he was in prison for good reasons, but he was able to get out and get elected. It's just a continual lawfare that's going to go on endlessly without this decision.
Right. This will nip that in the bud. I think Chris Calden's not agreeing with us on this point, but I think he sees the point we're making.
I agree with the logic of it, but I don't like the exceptions to the principle. Equal to all citizens should mean that.
So this makes me think, obviously, next of the other case that's sort of tangentially related, the Fisher versus U.S., which had to do with prosecution of the people who were breaking into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, apparently with some encouragement from the sitting president. And I guess the courts are going to sort out whether his encouragement of those people to do that did or didn't constitute an official act. But in any event, probably it did. At the same time, many of them are being prosecuted under the terms of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And the court considered that and decided on, I guess, what a 6-3 decision in which the majority included Ketanji Brown Jackson, that was an inappropriate way of applying that statute. Is that accurate, I wonder, Steve Holbrook, I was going to ask you and then Magnus, is that an accurate ruling on the applicability of Sarbanes-Oxley?
Well, the ruling is absolutely on point. There's a lot of federal statutes dealing with obstruction of justice. The one in question, Part 1 prohibits obstruction of justice in the form of destroying records and other things that were to be used in an official proceeding. And Part 2 is just other words for other stuff like that. And what the government has done is tried to prosecute based on the other stuff like that language. And what the court said was that you read that language in conjunction with what came before it. And if you allowed that kind of broad interpretation of the statute, you could prosecute people for any kind of obstruction of justice. And but it's a specific part of one section related to destruction of documents or intimidation of witnesses, things like that. And so it was quite a misuse of that language. And I'm not surprised Jackson got it right on that case. You know, she was originally a public defender. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. And you don't read statutes that way. One more point about that whole situation, this overextension of that statute is, you'll all remember back in 2020, the Mark Hatfield Judicial Center in Portland, Oregon, was attacked night after night with deadly force, you know, arson, the whole works, and none of those people were vigorously prosecuted.
No.
And that's been raised on behalf of the January 6 defendants, the idea of selective prosecution. And the motions have been denied, but there's quite a stark contrast here with what's been going on. And once again, I think Fisher corrects one aspect of the January 6 prosecutions, namely the overextension of a criminal law that had no place, never had any intention to be applied there.
But I mean, Steve, now the prosecutors are going to go back and have to find some other means, some other basis on which to charge those 300 people. That's so inconvenient.
Well, criminal laws aren't made for the convenience of prosecutors. And
oh, I think that's right.
Neither is the Constitution. There's a lot of reasons why good cases get dismissed because there's constitutional violations, for example. You read statutes according to the rule of lenity. That's been a topic that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh have been quarreling about lately. What's the standard for application of the rule of lenity where you strictly construe statutes against the government in the case of any ambiguity and in favor of defendants? But certainly the court came out exactly right in this case.
So, Phil Magnus, we were praising Amy Coney Barrett a few minutes ago. She was on the other side in this case. She says statutes often go further than the problem that inspired them, and under the rules of statutory interpretation, we stick to the text anyway, she said. What do you say about that, Magnus?
Unfortunately, I think that is a sign that she tends to be more on the prosecutorial side, tends to favor this practice of both overcharging people and extending the scope and range of statutes beyond their original intent. Now, she does end up in the minority on this particular case, which is interesting because it shows there's actually a bipartisan majority that recognizes this problem of misusing statutes, stretching their sentences, essentially shopping around in the federal statute book to find something that kind of resembles the act that they want to prosecute. That's a very bad practice, and the fact that the Supreme Court is slapping it down, you know, irrespective of the particulars of this case, it's a better principle that they're upholding. They're sending a signal to prosecutors and saying, no, you really can't do this.
Let's turn to the gun case. I think it's called Rahimi, United States versus Rahimi. Steve Hallberg,
hey, Graham, can I say one thing?
Published really interesting analysis. Oh, you may, sure. Jump in.
Just one quick thing on this case. I think Stephen's analysis is correct. I didn't think it was a tough call. It's almost like a law school exam. If a statute refers to lions, tigers, cheetahs, and other animals, the other animal is not an elephant. It would be of the same kind as those enumerated. And it's just like in this case, when you're dealing with records and record-keeping violations, essentially this came out of the Enron mess. The January 6 protesters were not doctoring or destroying documents in a litigation case or evidence. So it doesn't fit, and the court made a good call in this one.
And I do think it's very interesting that Jackson and Barrett were on opposite sides of this one. Very, very interesting. So I was going to ask Steve about U.S. versus Rahimi. You wrote a great piece on this in the Volokh conspiracy, which is also available on our website at independent.org. What's the gist of this one, Steve?
Well, Zaki Rahimi is not a guy you'd want to have living next door to you. He engaged in quite a lot of misbehavior. Him and his friend drove up to a fast food place. They didn't accept the friend's credit card, so he shoots at the building. I mean, he's been charged with various felonies under Texas law. But the issue here is whether the federal government can make it a crime to prohibit gun possession while being under the terms of a domestic violence protection order. And we'll leave aside, why is the federal government even involved in that topic? It's filled with...
Yeah, I was wondering about that, actually.
The jurisdictional hook is the Interstate Commerce Clause, because the gun has traveled in interstate commerce.
Right.
Well, it's been made in Texas. There would be no federal power over this case. But we'll leave that issue aside. We all know that the Commerce Clause has been extended well beyond any anticipated intent by the founders. But Rahimi did was to apply the Bruin case in a way that there was some disagreement between the 8-person majority and the dissenter, Justice Thomas. Thomas was the author, of course, of Bruin. Bruin highlighted the fundamental character of the right to keep and bear arms and invalidated New York's may issue gun carry permit system. And it threw away the old balancing test of intermediate scrutiny. And so what Bruin said was that you look at the text of the Second Amendment. Is the activity keeping and bearing arms? If the answer is yes, the presumption is that the government has to justify whatever the law is based on a historical understanding. And so the issue in Rahimi then becomes, were there historical precedents from the time of the adoption of the Second Amendment in 1791 or shortly thereafter, which indicated an intent that there would be exceptions to the Second Amendment, and what would they be?
And were there?
Here's where the disagreement, and I think it's fair to say there's a reasonable disagreement between Chief Justice Roberts and what he opined and what Justice Clarence Thomas said in his dissent. The court centered on two historical laws that have been actually around for centuries. One was the prohibition on going armed in a manner that terrorized other people. That would be reckless conduct where you, for example, in a public place, you brandish a firearm at other people, you yell that you're going to kill people, things like that. And so that was a common law offense. Another type of law was a surety law, equivalent today to posting a bond to keep the peace. In other words, if people complained about you and said you're making threats or you're causing potentially disruptive behavior or a breach of the peace, then you might be required to post an amount of money. You would be required to find sureties to keep the peace, essentially, meaning that you have to find somebody like a bondsman today to put down money, and which will be forfeited if you repeated the misbehavior. And so those laws did require a showing via court to a court that there was violence that was threatened. And when we look at the federal statute in mind here, there has to be a finding that a judicial finding that the person poses a credible threat to the physical safety of an intimate party or some other domestic relation. And so Chief Justice Roberts said that's close enough, it's relevantly similar. So the issue was how similar does it have to be? And what I really like about the case is we had Sotomayor dissent, concurrence joined by Kagan, and then we had another concurrence by Jackson, but those were almost like the sense. They hate the text and history test that the court has zeroed in on. They would really like to see it go away, and they said they disagreed with the Bruin precedent. But of course, they voted to affirm the conviction because they wanted the judgment of conviction to be upheld. And what Justice Thomas did a lot of in his dissent was to basically pounce on some of the bad arguments that the government has been making in the court below. They didn't make it in the Supreme Court, but in the Fifth Circuit they made it, and they made it, they've been making it in many other cases. So things like, oh, well, there were the slave codes. That's the kind of historical precedent that we can cite to uphold other federal laws today. Or guns were banned in possession of Indians. Or the Tories were disarmed by the Patriots in the Revolution. And so what Thomas did was to basically explain why none of those historical precedents count. And there was certainly no disagreement by the majority that those don't count. So it was good riddance to kind of sweep that under the rug, in the sense that there's no point in the government continuing to argue that in other cases, other prohibitions under the Federal Gun Control Act, they're trying to justify by use of historical laws that were very bad precedents for today.
Yeah, so what about a person who lives in a dangerous neighborhood where it would make sense to carry a firearm for self-protection, but he's under this restraining order? Why not have that individual post a bond instead of barring that individual, probably a male, barring him from carrying a firearm? It seems like the old remedy is better than the current one.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I would point out there's another problem which the court did not decide. So in the Rahimi case, the prong that he was convicted under that the decision upheld this law facially was there has to be a court order of a credible threat to the physical safety of another person. But the other prong that you can also convict people under says that if a protective order is entered where a person basically is ordered not to commit domestic violence, then you're disarmed there also. And we know many times both couples in a divorce case, they'll agree not to harass or to commit violence against the other one. Well, sure, I'll sign that. I have no intention of doing it. And once you sign these mutually agreed orders, then you're under the federal ban.
Sounds way too inclusive.
Pardon?
He says it's
too inclusive, Steve, the way they have the statute.
Exactly. That's why, again, the laws that were originally cited as historical precedents, and particularly the requirement that find sureties to keep the peace. In fact, the Massachusetts law that has been talked about the most from about the 1820s basically said there has to be a complaint and a finding that you're endangering another person. You can defend yourself, and what the judge would order is you have to have find sureties to keep the peace so you don't do it in the future. And so, that makes more sense. But keep in mind, these federal laws are passed as feel-good legislation. There was no need for this federal law because it's already against the law in every state to assault other people, including domestic partners, to murder them, and the whole works. And so, it was just a question of, oh, why don't we do something about domestic violence, which is not a federal jurisdictional issue.
Right, in the first place, yeah. So some people might say, Steve Albrick, well, we just want to know, are you for a gun control or against it? But I think in this case, your position is a little more subtle. It sounds like in this case, you think it's just as well that the bad guy, was convicted and was not allowed to have the gun. But what you care about is the basis and the reasoning on which these restrictions are made. And in this case, it sounds like the reasoning was anchored well in both the text and the history, and so you approved. Have I got that right?
Look, I filed an amicus brief in support of Rahimi, and so I argued there that the federal law is facially unconstitutional in violation of the Second Amendment. And at the same time, like Justice Thomas emphasized, the real solution here is the criminal law. If people are harassing others and if they're making threats and assaulting, you've got to take them to court and incarcerate them or do whatever else. But just issuing a piece of paper, a protective order, we've heard too many stories where those protective orders are violated and a woman ends up dead from some disgruntled husband. And so it's a superficial solution to a problem. And, you know, with Thomas, he wants them to get tough on criminals and not rely on these kinds of types of laws that, look, the states are free to, if they think somebody's misbehaving, a domestic partner's misbehaving to a great extent, they can issue a no-weapon order. They can make judicial findings that you can get the protection of the criminal law. You have due process. You have right to counsel and all of that. Whereas these state-issued protective orders frequently are based on a mere preponderance of evidence where judges think,
right.
So you could lose a constitutional right.
If something goes wrong, I'm going to be blamed.
You could lose a constitutional right based on preponderance of evidence. There's also a problem, as you mentioned, getting the criminal justice system to take care of the person, because the prosecutorial authorities may say, well, we have other priorities. Forget it. We're not getting into this. So we used to have in England, in centuries past, private attorneys general or private prosecutorial things in criminal cases. That would address this, but that's not what we have now in the United States.
Sounds like what you're saying, Steve Halbrich, is that at least the decision affirmed the Bruin test.
Right, it's a narrow ruling. That's why the three so-called liberal justices were squawking about it. Their comments were that this Bruin text history test is hard to apply. The lower courts don't know what to do. Well, it's being applied by many lower courts, and I can tell you there's many courts that are in rebellion against the Bruin test, just like they rebelled against Heller when it originally came down. But if you look at other constitutional rights, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, you'll find any number of cases where the Supreme Court has relied on text and history. They go back to like the abuses in regard to grand juries and the liberty of the press, the things that the colonists rebelled against. And so this text history test is nothing new. It got revived by Heller, and then when he was Judge Kavanaugh in the D.C. Circuit, he dissented in this case called Heller II that I litigated, and he continued his enterprise in the concurrence in Rahimi, where he goes into great length to justify reliance on text and history. But if there's ever a conflict, the text governs.
I'd like to point out for our listeners and viewers that, in fact, the Heller case and the outcome in that case was, in fact, strongly influenced by your own legal history work. And I'm grateful to you for that, Steve Halbrich. I'm going to change the subject. Unless somebody needs to jump in on guns, I'm going to change the subject to the question of federal regulatory power. And Bill Watkins, you wrote this interesting piece saying the Chevron deference is no more on our beacon, which is at independent.org. And pretty intriguing. Some people may get confused. Does this mean Chevron was litigating before the Chevron Oil Company was litigating before the U.S. Supreme Court? I think the answer is no. Can you explain the case to us and the significance, Bill Watkins?
So back in 1984, the Supreme Court issued a decision. And of course, Chevron was a party, and it's the rule essentially is this: if Congress, say, has passed a statute and it's in the bailiwick of a certain administrative agency. And if the agency's interpretation of the statute is reasonable, because the statute doesn't definitively say X, Y, or Z, but there's some possible ambiguity, and so long as the agency has a reasonable interpretation that it applies, the court is to defer to the experts in that agency when reviewing their decision. Now, of course, in 1984, was this a really big deal? No, not really. Yes, we still had the administrative state, but good old Ronald Reagan had his people in charge and the bureaucracy, and we were expecting a rollback of this, that, and the other. So no big deal, right? Well, of course, years go by. The administrative state is the governing agency in American law, essentially a quasi-legislative, judicial, and executive body. And it's become more so over the years. And this is a big issue today. Well, the court, in striking essentially Chevron deference, used the Administrative Procedures Act. And the APA essentially states an unremarkable proposition that the United States courts shall have the final say. It's their job under the APA to interpret statutes and the Constitution. And so the court, looking at the APA and this clear command versus Chevron, says Chevron's incongruent with it, that statutory interpretation is something courts do every day. It's part of their core function, and there is no reason for them to defer to an agency that has, say, more skin in the game, more personal interest in how to interpret the statute than an impartial judge or panel of judges, and therefore it struck Chevron deference down, though it hasn't, the Supreme Court hasn't really applied Chevron deference in a decade, but it's been on the books. It influences lower courts, but now it is gone, and that is a victory over the administrative state, but I don't think we should just celebrate too much. It's a small victory, something to be thankful for, but it's not an end-all and be-all.
So federal agency regulators, therefore, don't have as much leeway and sway
as they might have. That's absolutely right. Essentially, the court can overrule certain interpretations of statute that under Chevron, if it was reasonable, they could leave alone, even if they thought there was a better interpretation. So yes, that cuts back on some of the administrative state's power there, but let's not fool ourselves. We're essentially exchanging one set of unelected officials to interpret statutes and make rules for another set in the judiciary. While it might be a somewhat improvement from the prior situation, we still have the core issue, as Gary Lawson puts it often, that back in the 1930s, we could have chosen the Constitution or the administrative state, and we chose the administrative state. There are separation of powers problems, there are non-delegation problems. There are a number of problems with the American administrative state, and they still exist after Chevron. This is a small chip or chink in the armor, shall we say, of the administrative state, but those big issues remain.
We've been talking about Loper, Bright versus Raimondo. I think that's the name of the case. Chevron's not in the name of the case. Phil Magnus, would you like to comment any further on the significance of this partial, tiny rollback in the powers
of administrative sway? It's finally shining a light on the fact that some of these bureaucrats have been running amok for several decades in essentially assuming a legislative function on their own behalf. It's also showing that bureaucrats are not impartial actors. They actually have a stake in the game, and they carry forth political edicts. So the fact that this case even exists is showing a part of the government that most people really don't pay attention to or think about in their day-to-day interaction. And, you know, you pull back the curtain there, it's not always pretty. It's not always something that we are expecting our government to do. I think this was even in Bill's case, he made the point that, you know, bureaucrats are very prone to extending statutes well beyond their original wording and framing themselves.
Is it ever in their interest to do so?
Because what is it? What motivates a bureaucrat? They want to attain more power for themselves. They want to look like they're doing something, creating policy. They want bigger budgets for their office. And the easiest way to do that is to expand the scope of your own domain. So that the fact that this was going on unchallenged for several decades here has finally had some attention shown to it. We'll push back in the other direction.
Watkins or Evers, any further comment on this before I turn the page one more time?
All I would do is repeat Phil's point that bureaucrats seek to expand the scope of their jurisdiction, of their power, their bailiwick, expand their budget, expand the number of lesser bureaucrats under their sway. And William Niskanen had this insight as part of public choice economics many decades ago, and it certainly held up well as a way to look at and analyze government behavior.
Thank you. So, okay, next case. City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. Grants Pass is a city in Oregon. I'm going to ask Chris Carlton to comment on this one. He wrote an interesting piece on this on our website for the Beacon at independent.org. Seems like the city of Grants Pass, Chris, was kind of mean to their homeless
population.
If
you listen to the naysayers, it's all throwing people in prison or concentration camps. But the reality, what Grants Pass did, just for the context for listeners that may not be aware, is it overturned a 2018 circuit court decision, Martin v. Boise, which basically said that cities cannot enforce bans against public camping, which had strong implications for homeless encampments, so it doesn't apply exclusively to that. They can't enforce these bans unless they have adequate shelter to house the homeless population. And Grants Pass overturned this decision. And the basic argument was on the constitutional protection against cruel and unusual punishment, which the argument in Martin v. Boise was, because homelessness is an involuntary status, this is cruel and unusual. So it was not applying to the punishment, which was kind of unusual, but applying it to the crime. And there's only one case, I think, that has ever accepted that argument. It's a 1962 case that said California can't enforce a law against addiction to drugs. It can enforce drug prohibition, but it can't enforce against the status of addiction. And that was kind of the crux of the argument. In Martin, the justices, the majority, rejected this logic. In this one, they cited another case in 1968 in Texas where somebody made a similar argument against a public intoxication law because he was an alcoholic. It shouldn't apply to him because that was involuntary. The courts rejected this. So this was the basic foundation of the decision. More interesting, though, I think, was the Gorsuch's exposition into just kind of like the implications of the Martin decision, the practical implications that this had on cities trying to enforce public camping ordinances. It's really not something where cities are arresting people and throwing them in jail and locking away the key, as many people on the far left often will kind of have us believe. What it is usually people that are working for nonprofits, are working for government agencies that are trying to get the homeless into shelters, trying to get them into programs maybe for recovery from drug addiction or treatment for mental illness. But you can't do this if you don't have a mechanism by which you can intervene, right? And that's what Martin really put a stop to, because in theory, it sounds like an eminently reasonable decision, right? It's like you just have to have adequate shelter. The problem is the language of involuntary homeless is very ambiguous, and the language of adequate shelter is very ambiguous. And so what this ended up doing in the six years or so since the Martin decision is leaving cities that are trying to do something about their homeless encampments tied up in courts, right? Where how do you prove that homelessness is involuntary for a given individual? It's very easy to find examples of people saying they like their homeless. The Department of Homeland, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has published reports citing this, where you have people saying, "Oh, I live in the encampment because I like the freedom, or because I like to be, you know, close to my drug dealer." It's going back to the 1920s. We have a formerly homeless person acknowledging this about heroin addicts, right? So obviously, in the age of fentanyl, that's a very strong pull for these encampments, right? So obviously, there are cases of voluntary homelessness. But how do you prove that in the courts? It's very easy to contest.
Very difficult. You'd have to like delve into people's inner psychology.
Exactly.
Can the law delve into inner psychology that well?
Adequate shelter is a very difficult thing to prove in courts, right? Because one, we don't keep running tallies, day-to-day tallies of the homeless population, and homeless counts are already notoriously inaccurate. So this is almost an impossible burden to expect cities to have this running tally of their homeless population. But then even where they had a shelter system, if you have 500 shelter beds and a homeless population of 501, then you can't enforce this public camping ban against any of them. And so what happened after Martin v. Boise was that cities were actually seeing a decline in people using their shelter system. Seattle was cited in the decision for this, hardly a MAGA city, right? This is not a far-right city here, but they were complaining about the Martin decision because they couldn't get people into their shelter system because of this, right? And so this was this seemingly reasonable stipulation that you just have to provide enough shelter beds really came undone in practice. Other problem with adequate, too, by the way, some of the court decisions since Martin were saying, oh, well, you have to supply X, Y, and Z. You have to have enough restrooms. You have to have on-site medical treatment, like all of these different provisions that could essentially extend endlessly because of that ambiguous word adequate, right? And so all these ambiguities in practice made a seemingly reasonable decision, essentially tying the hands completely of cities to be able to do something about their encampments.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of this sounds like sort of tinkering with the welfare state. I mean, I don't have a real problem with this decision, but the points that Chris is making about how to decide, you know, when adequate is this and when the other is inadequate and all this stuff is like fine-tuning the welfare state. Now, suppose you treated the sidewalks as private property. In other words, a lot of people pay taxes on the property just up to the sidewalk, but they might pay taxes right up to the street, depending. I'm not an expert on this, but I believe that can be the case. If your sidewalk was treated as your private property, you could cite the people that are encamped there as trespassers. And that would solve this question of when it's time to vacate. It's when the property owner says, you're not my guest anymore.
Yeah, just
Bill Watkins had a comment.
To take this back to the Eighth Amendment.
I believe he did anyway.
The Eighth Amendment was the basis of the lower court's decision. And this is a good decision by the Supreme Court, because it brings us back to an original understanding that cruel and unusual punishments refer to methods and means of punishment. Things that are cruel and unusual would be like torture, drawing and quartering someone, burning them at the stake. They are the punishments that are imposed after a conviction. The Eighth Amendment does not apply pre-conviction to criminalization of things. As Chris pointed out, there's one Supreme Court case that made status with the addicts that applied the Eighth Amendment that shouldn't have and should have been overruled. And, you know, it's clearly from this case, it's limited to its facts. But we're back to methods and means of punishment is what the Eighth Amendment looks at, not the substantive crime. So that's a good decision.
Yeah,
Yeah, and it seems to me that there's a tendency in American law among many courts, and until recently the U.S. Supreme Court, find some way to make a constitutional provision be the leverage to get, you know, some
right.
provision of social services that the Constitution doesn't envision. Any ingenious use of any provision seems to have been fair game, and this seems to be cutting back on that.
Yes.
Bill Evers had a comment.
Discussion of independent outlook having to do with Hunter Biden and addiction, something. So Chris brought up this case and Bill Watkins commented on it, and that had to do with the status of being an addict, being diagnosed as in addiction. And I brought up, and I would repeat this point, that generally classical liberals shy away from the state labeling people in some status and making that status to be criminal. In other words, if they're brandishing a gun, that's the crime, not the crime of being a gun owner, a gun bearer, or something like that. It's the overt act that's a threat to other people that you want to be criminal.
And if I may
criminal.
Add to that, we have a recent example of why the court rejected that argument, right? What Gorsuch said was homelessness the Martin v. Boise decision, is not criminalizing the status of being homeless, which was the argument, because the bans against public camping apply to everybody. And we see that now, right? We have these encampments from these students that are protesting Israel. Whether you agree with it or not, right? These are not homeless students. These are students that are setting up a campus as a form of protest. So they want to do that in a public park. These ordinances apply to them as well. And so that was kind of the argument, is it's not criminalizing a status because it applies equally to everybody, right? It may have special implications for homeless encampments for many cities, but it's not a law targeting homeless individuals.
I think on this point, you can be like me. I mean, I think that people should have adequate housing, but it doesn't follow from that I believe the Eighth Amendment requires it, or that there is a constitutional right that should be enforced that people should get it. I think people should have it, and we should find all sorts of community, voluntary, and other ways to provide it, but not use the law in a kind of pretextual way to make it seem as if the law requires it. It just doesn't. And so I hope people don't just say, oh, well, yeah, good for them, get grants passed, cleaned up, forget those homeless people. I hope that they instead say, yes, we have to abide by the law and not distort it. But let's help homeless
some other way.
One
of the things I really liked about this decision, so I wrote my statement on it before I read Gorsuch's full opinion, because the basic ruling is pretty simple. Pretty straightforward, but the opinion echoed a point that I was making, which was a Hayekian point, right? It's the use of knowledge in society, localized, particularized knowledge versus general knowledge. And, you know, what I said in my statement was federal judges, you know, no matter how wise they are, they don't have the knowledge of the local conditions of each city in terms of what needs to be done about the homeless population, because this problem does not look the same in San Francisco as it does in Miami. Both cities have homeless problems, but they look very different, right? Unsheltered homelessness is much higher in California, for example, than in the rest of the country, right? And so you do need that localized knowledge to know what policy approaches is appropriate. And I was very pleased when I read Gorsuch's opinion. He echoed this point. Kyle, I guess I was echoing it because he made it first. I just read it second. But he made this point repeatedly throughout his decision.
Independently came to this wise conclusion.
He repeatedly made the point that local officials better know the conditions of their city and therefore are in a better position to craft policy for addressing the homelessness problem. And I think that is the most important takeaway for people to understand. All the grants pass decision does was defer these decisions to the cities. It doesn't mandate any policy and it doesn't tie their hands. It just says, let local officials who know the conditions of their city best decide what approach to take. And then let's compare, Let's compare notes and see which has the best outcomes. And that's the way federalism is designed to work, right? And so it basically just restored the federalist logic, the decentralization of power logic in the case of homelessness policy for cities.
Nicely put, Chris. We're going to turn to the last chapter for today. I'm going to ask Phil Magnus to talk a little bit about this case, Murthy versus Missouri. This one's kind of confusing to me, Phil, because the social media companies were asserting their free speech rights, but then others who were squelched by the social media companies were asserting their free speech rights.
This is a case that goes back to the COVID era when we had this wave of censorship across social media platforms. And it turns out that the Biden administration was putting its thumb on the scale and really aggressively pressuring Facebook and Twitter, now X, and several other platforms to take certain voices that were dissenting from the pro-lockdown, pro-vaccine mandate lines that were favored by the administration at the time. In fact, I was involved in one of the early discoveries of this. So the case actually grew out of Freedom of Information Act requests. One of them was the one that Ethan Yang and myself filed that discovered Fauci and Francis Collins at the NIH were putting out these edicts to take down, to write devastating takedowns of the Great Barrington Declaration scientists, who were some of the plaintiffs in the case. So what they did is they filed a lawsuit seeking an injunction against federal authorities telling them that they could no longer go to Facebook or Twitter or Google or any of these social media companies and put pressure on them to do their dirty work, to do their censorship for them. Because the federal government, they're banned by the First Amendment from restricting free speech. But they were trying to get private actors to do this for them. So the case advanced through district court and the appellate court, which basically upheld that this was illegal and unconstitutional for Fauci and his other members of the federal bureaucracy to engage in this type of censorship through private third parties. On their behalf. Now, what happened in the federal Supreme Court ruling is they hear the case and Amy Coney Barrett writes the decision for the majority. She basically pushes the case back down to the lower court on a standing issue, a technicality. And her argument was, well, the plaintiffs had not proven that they have standing. And also, we're not going to review the evidence that they presented that showed that they have standing. Therefore, so it's kind of like this circularity. And I'd urge everyone to read the final paragraph of her ruling. It's self-referential circular reasoning. She says they don't have standing, nor do they have an opportunity to prove their standing. Therefore, they don't have standing. Problem with that is both the district court and the Fifth Circuit extensively reviewed the evidence that did establish standing. And they both saw that there was a pathway forward here under some fairly conventional existing legal precedents. So I think, unfortunately, what's coming out of this case is Barrett's decision in saying that they don't have standing. It leaves no practical means to seek redress for something that the government did to suppress free speech through private actors. And in so doing, it's kind of like an unofficial green light to the Biden administration to continue doing this in the future. To other presidents, you're doing exactly.
Or other future administrations who may lean on those social media companies from other angles and be very powerful
yes,
in so
I
doing.
Phil Evers had a comment. I saw a post by Josh Blackman on the Volokh conspiracy where he observed that most of the people on the Supreme Court have a surprising amount of practical experience in government. Maybe in a prosecutor's office, maybe in criminal defense, maybe in an executive agency, one thing or another, but that Amy Coney Barrett is basically a faculty member who's been elevated. Now, you know, I've been a faculty member. Several of you who are with me here have been faculty members. But I think Blackman makes a kind of a sociological or social psychology point that her decision in this case sort of smells of the faculty seminar. In other words, it's highly technical, but it's not something that would have been written by someone who had practical experience in law enforcement. And so I think, you know, not only are Phil's points very sound about the catch-22 aspects of this, but also there's a stylistic thing to watch out for in her decisions in the future.
Very interesting. Well, I think that my thought here is that it's regrettable, and the Orange County Register put it this way,
right.
Supreme Court flubs an opportunity to defend free speech. I thought that was a pretty apt headline. I'm afraid that's all we can say for today. We have given a pretty fast-paced run-through on not even all the cases, but a number of the pivotal cases. I'm so grateful for the expertise of my friends, William Watkins and Stephen Holbrook and Philip Magnuson, Bill Everson, Christopher Carlton. Grateful for your willingness to talk about these things. We hope that our friends around the country will benefit from this conversation. And of course, we always invite you to visit our website at independent.org, where you can find some of the pieces, published pieces that we have referred to, and a lot of other good information to help make you an informed citizen, especially if you care about liberty. So from the Independent Institute, I'm thanking all my friends and saying goodbye to our visitors and viewers, and inviting you to come next time to join us on Independent Outlook. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.